today I'm here with Mark Gordson. Mark is the founder of LimeWire. He works now at a high-frequency trading company in New York, and he actually sent me by email his latest website, which he will tell us about, and has also been working on a project called Open Plans in New York, which a lot of people are excited about. So, Mark, thanks for joining us, and welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Do you want to just tell us a little bit about who you are and where you come from?
Sure. I live in New York City. I'm a technology entrepreneur. I grew up in New Jersey in a town called Oradell, which is just 15 miles from New York City, so just a suburb of New York. I mean, I'm sure I could go... What part of the background do you want?
Everything. Tell us whatever you want to say.
Oh, so I grew up in Oradell, went to the local public school there, then I went off to college at Yale, studied electrical engineering there, went and got a master's in electrical engineering at Stanford, then I worked at Martin Marietta for a couple years doing digital signal processing stuff, and then from there I went to Harvard Business School. And after that, I got a job as a trader at First Boston, which became CS First Boston, and then later Credit Suisse. Worked there for about 5 years, and then I went and I started Tower Research Capital, which is the quantitative trading firm that I still run today. And then along the way, I have started a few other businesses and ventures and things like that.
So you've been taking it really easy all your life, is what you're trying to say?
Yes, that's about it.
Sounds like you've been busy. A comment that one of my friends, who's an internet guy here in New York, wanted me to ask you is, why are you not on Twitter?
Oh, I have thought about tweeting. I mean, for the most part, I'm not actually very much of a user of social media myself. So, and it's not like I have that much that I'm eager to say on any regular basis. So, I mean, I have, like you say, I'm doing a lot of other things. I don't really have time to be good at tweeting.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, if you did decide to get on there, I'm sure a lot of people would be interested.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, who knows? Maybe one of these days. I don't know. It's just nothing I've ever really done, but I suppose it's not a crazy thing to do.
I mean, one of the guys that's interesting on there is Rupert Murdoch, and dude's like 80 something, and he posts really interesting stuff, and it's not always written quite right, and every so often it's a little bit odd what he says, but I would actually honestly say he's one of the most interesting people I follow on Twitter, just really out there. But anyway, so why don't we talk about start with LimeWire, and maybe can you tell us how you founded that, how that came about, and what you can tell us from the story.
Sure. So, I mean, this, I guess, goes back to 2000 or something like that. This is back during the heyday of the internet bubble. And as part of the overall initial internet bubble, there was a mini bubble in P2P technology. And at that time, there was a lot of excitement around P2P, and there was talk that you could reinvent the whole internet using P2P technology, and I jumped into that, and I started LimeWire.
And so did you go out and raise money, or was it all self-funded?
No, it was funded by myself. I mean, so I took some of the profits that I had made from my trading, and I used it to fund LimeWire.
Oh, so you were always trading. This was just like an extra thing that you went into.
Yeah, LimeWire was never my main business. So, I mean, Tower Research Capital is not nearly as well known as LimeWire, but LimeWire, I mean, I never worked full-time on LimeWire. It was really a kind of side thing, which got to be very well known, and so a lot of people know about it, but in terms of what I've actually been doing, LimeWire was a relatively small amount of it.
But I imagine in the end it attracted a greater amount of time than maybe you intended.
For the most part, I never really spent that much time on it. And at the end, I got a good CEO in there by the name of George Searle, who did a really good job running it. So I mean, even there has never been a point of time in which I didn't spend more time on Tower than I did on LimeWire.
And so you did, the idea of P2P sharing was hot, and you had the trading business was doing well. You thought you'd try and do something else, so get LimeWire started, and that started to take off and get traction, and that's where it went. Is that basically how it happened?
Yeah, exactly. And we had a bunch of ideas in the beginning that were how you could take P2P technology and use that for all sorts of distributed search. And some of those ideas, I think, there is some validity to them. But a lot of the stuff, I imagined having a whole kind of business ecosystem using P2P technology that never really got bootstrapped, and so what ended up happening is that it was a big file sharing network, and a lot of the other ideas we had never got off the drawing board, really.
And what was the thing that, how did you get traction in the beginning? I mean, a lot of people have tried to build file sharing networks or just P2P networks, and they failed. Like, what made yours work?
I think we had a good team of engineers, and some of it is just basic performance and making the software work well. That was really always our focus. I mean, we were always an engineering-oriented company, and just focused on just the basics of performance. And I think since we built a very good performing file sharing application, people recognized that, and we grew that way.
And was that in the same area as Tower Research, or was that somewhere, like, were you basically initially working two businesses at the same time and then going between them a couple of days a week, or, like, was it in the same
place? LimeWire and Tower were all in Lower Manhattan, just a few blocks from each other.
So LimeWire takes off. How was it as a business?
It was fine. It's one of those businesses where it had a huge number of users, and you don't make particularly much money off of any one user, but just given the large numbers and the fact that we weren't that large of a business in terms of people, I mean, it was a profitable business in its heyday.
Right. How many people did you have working in its biggest?
And its biggest, we must have had 75 at the peak or something like that.
Because, I mean, I've used, LimeWire in the past, and I remember it being massive. I mean, you guys were really, like, insanely huge with how big you got back then. I guess that's the leverage of the Internet.
Yeah, I mean, there were, in terms of number of people using it, I think we got up to 50 million people a month or something like that. But again, because it's all P2P, I mean, we just made a piece of software that people downloaded. I mean, all of the operations of the network were distributed on people's computers, so it didn't take, we weren't involved in the operation of the network, and as such, it probably scaled a lot more easily because it's not like we needed a whole lot of servers or anything like that to support that amount of traffic. It was all distributed on the network.
So I think it's happened once or twice where the Skype network actually crashed. Did you ever have problems like that?
I guess this is one of the advantages and disadvantages of a highly decentralized network is that you don't ever get any sort of true robustness. I mean, it was in some ways kind of always crashing in some small way. But it was also robust because it was redundant, because people are kind of popping on and off the network all the time. And so it was fairly dynamic and kind of robust because it was just so many different people connecting to so many other people that you could have probably pockets of it that fail while other ones are doing fine.
I know I'm like drawing on your memory here, and this is stuff you probably haven't done for that long. It's a topic I find interesting. Have you been working on any P2P stuff since then, or are you pretty much done with it?
No, I haven't worked on it yet, not in a while.
Yeah, it would seem like there's got to be more that can happen with it, but I guess Well, maybe can you talk about it? So,
well, I mean, so when you're, if you're just talking about P2P, I mean, one of the drawbacks of it is that you, that this lack of reliability, and I think that that really does limit its application in some sense, because there are a lot of transactions out there that people really want to be highly reliable. And it was, and it didn't offer that, which is sort of fine for what it was. But I think as a technology, I mean, honestly, after, and just the, all of the problems making search, distributed search is a much, much, much more difficult problem than centralized search. And you see just how wonderfully Google works. And LimeWire could never even get global search work for the Nutella network. Everyone had a limited search horizon. It was, and so
I remember search was slow. Like I'd search for something and it would take a minute to find everything.
Yeah, and because you would have these things that had to propagate out of the network and touch a bunch of different machines and then come back through lower bandwidth connections and things like that. So it just in terms of LimeWire compared to the capabilities of Google. I mean, I would honestly am now much more of a believer in centralized things. I like, for sort of philosophical reasons, I like decentralized things. It kind of bothers me that Google has this kind of giant near monopoly control of search. But from an engineering point of view, I don't think there's any arguing that centralized search works better than decentralized search.
Well, we have Google and then Facebook as well. Doing the same, and Twitter is also doing the same sort of things. They're centralized services. Are you on Facebook?
No.
Oh, and so, I mean, Facebook's obviously important to a lot of people, and it's centralizing this whole concept of, from the early days, the friend of a friend network, and that's what Facebook is, and they own it. So, yeah, it is mildly problematic, and it concerns people.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to. There's no ideal solutions there. It would be nice if everyone controlled their own stuff, and I think people would have to care a lot more than they do now. I think most people just don't really care about a lot of those things.
Yeah, no, exactly. But so, for example, Skype works well as a peer-to-peer network. I mean, I can do most of my calls reasonably well. I can do video on it, and all, I mean those things. It's not always great. But most of the time it is.
I actually don't know the details of how Skype really works, so it's hard for me to know what they do to make things work well.
Right. And I mean, and this is interesting to me because you're a trading guy who is, what, an electrical engineer. Like, how on earth did you even get into peer-to-peer file sharing? That would seem quite far away from your area of focus.
Well, I guess the one thing that pretty much all of my businesses have in common is a technology focus, and I have experience running engineering teams from my work at Tower, and so that software development experience, I mean, Tower is really a collection of engineers for the most part, and so it's much more similar to a software company than it is a traditional finance company. And so it's really not as much of a reach as you would think for me to be running kind of one engineering company or another engineering company.
So for you, it's just hiring more engineers and motivating them to get projects done?
Well, there's a little more than that, but it's yeah, there's that is common to everything.
What about the business of LimeWire? Can you talk about some of the revenue numbers or where that went or how the business model worked?
I mean, so the business model, we sold LimeWire Pro. And so we gave away a free version, and we sold LimeWire Pro. And, I mean, I don't think I want to go into the exact revenue numbers, but it was real money for a while.
Did you have concerns as this was going on about, the problems with the RIAA that ended up coming along?
Yeah, I mean, probably I was a bit naive. I thought that there was such a good opportunity and that LimeWire reached so many people who the RIAA would want to be able to engage with. And I spent a lot of time working with the record labels trying to convince them that we could help them bridge the gap between the younger generation and what they were doing. And the last few years of LimeWire, where we spent almost all of our effort building this great subscription music service. I mean, the untold story of LimeWire is that we had a music subscription service that was really better than iTunes in a box, ready to go, and we were working out licensing deals with the major record labels, and we had worked out deals with three of the four major record labels, the independents and the publishers, and we just couldn't reach a deal with the last one, and so the whole thing fell apart, and it was really, really a great loss for everybody. I mean, it would have been a fantastic opportunity for the music industry, and it you know, ended up as nothing. And again, this is, we're not the only tech company that walked away from their dealings with the music industry thinking it was a giant waste of time.
And so you had an agreement in place with all of the labels except for one.
It wasn't like an official. There were some things that were signed agreements with certain parties, and some things were kind of a term sheet basis. But I mean, at the end of the day, there was really just one record label that didn't want to do the deal.
So it could have actually worked, and then you could have been the iTunes of where things are at now.
That was the hope.
Although I guess Kim from Mega Upload is saying that maybe they're also still pretty hard to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I never heard of Mega Upload up until a few months ago when this guy was in the paper. I mean, again, it's really, I mean, as much as I'm known for LimeWire, it wasn't my main business, and it kind of didn't pay that much attention to. It's not, I don't really listen to music. It's not, I don't have an iPod. Like, I don't, it's not really my thing. And it's just, I mean, it's sort of funny how everyone, I guess, it thinks of me and LimeWire and sort of, I think they project, some sort of ideas about me. You know, they sort of know LimeWire, and then they just assume that I'm some sort of like living personification of LimeWire, and it really was this kind of side business I had that wasn't my main focus.
It's just something that's very interesting, and I mean, it had a lot of influence. But so, why don't you your main business is Tower Research?
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? I mean, this is an area my questions will be fairly trivial because I don't know anything about any of this sort of stuff, but maybe if you can just enlighten us, that would be great.
So, I mean, Tower Research Capital is a quantitative trading firm. We do a lot of automated computerized trading. We have about 300 people worldwide, a lot of very high-speed computers, high-speed telecom connections between various markets around the world. We process a huge amount of data in real time, and we trade a whole lot. We have really good teams of engineers who are processing this data and trying to build trading models that have some predictive power, and a bunch of the guys we have here are good at that, and we're reasonably successful as a proprietary trading firm.
And so there was an article in the press saying that guys like you are bad because you're taking the human element out of the market. And I'm sorry, but I really laughed when I saw that. And I'd be curious as to your comments.
There's no doubt about it that markets are automated now in a way that they weren't 15 years ago. I think that is actually a positive thing. Markets are more efficient now than they've ever been before. They're cheaper to trade for end investors, for everybody involved. And we've never had markets that are more efficient than what we have today. And that really has radically lowered the trading costs for individual investors, institutional investors. And a lot of them do recognize that there are benefits. I mean, you have Vanguard has said publicly that they think the investor in an average mutual fund will retire with 30% more money in their retirement account because of the reduction in transaction costs, which is pretty substantial. But what you do have is there is an old guard on Wall Street who had really nice, profitable jobs intermediating these orders, and now those jobs are being automated out of existence. And for the end customers, that's good because you have less high-paid middlemen in there, and you're able to transact cheaper because of that. But for these guys at banks and the big brokerage firms who made very good money picking up the phone and calling in orders and things like that, they're unhappy with that, and they are pretty vocal that high-frequency trading, you know, that they don't like high-frequency trading, and they blame it for all sorts of things, and we've been accused of all sorts of things without any merit, but it leads to a rather politicized discussion around this topic.
So is that why when there's these big market crashes, it all gets blamed on high-frequency trading? Is that part of why that's happening?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people. One, high-frequency trading is somewhat new, and people don't understand it so well. But I think some of it is that there are some very sophisticated players out there who are cleverly trying to distort the public's perception of things. And again, it's high-frequency trading, because it is new and is unfamiliar to the general public, is sort of easy to tar as being mysterious and evil and all sorts of things like that, when if you actually take a look at it, none of that's true, and it's actually been part of the changes on Wall Street. I would say of the changes on Wall Street that have happened in the last 20 years, this has really been one of the big pluses for the general public. I mean, there have been lots and lots of things that Wall Street has done. If you want to go to credit default swaps or subprime loans, and you know, all sorts of things that have really been horrible for the financial markets and for the world, high-frequency trading is actually one of the things that has led to cost savings for investors, and it's sort of a shame that the general public has a hard time distinguishing that between the people that are making subprime loans.
So, aside from the cost, the reduction in trading costs or trading overhead, what is the value provided to society by high-frequency trading?
I mean, it's really more efficient markets, and then the society sees that value as lower trading costs, and at the end of the day, more money in their bank accounts. But it's just markets that function better with the spreads are narrower than ever for trading. Trading costs are lower, and it's just as simple as that, really.
So that means on a day when I want to sell a stock, and maybe it's not a very liquid stock, there's more chance that you guys will be in there doing trading on it, so that I can make that sale more easily.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's for over 100 years, it's been possible for you to pick a stock and buy it and sell it on any given day. The question is, how much did you have to pay? What was the slippage in order to do that transaction? And it used to be that 50 basis points, a half a percent, was pretty common to do just a basic stock trade. And now that you see that's probably dropped by a factor of 10 or something like that. And so that, I mean, that really adds up. I mean, a lot of people who are average investors don't really understand how much it costs to transact a stock, because a lot of that is invisible. A lot of it comes down to what price did you get. And for any one trade, it's hard to know what the right price is or should have been. But if you do enough, you can kind of get a sense of what your average trading costs are.
And so what would be, I mean, you guys come up, what would be a strategy that you would come up with that you would trade against? Like, can you tell us something that you've done a couple of years ago that's no longer valid to the markets, but that, you know, was an important strategy for you?
Well, I think I'm going to be pretty vague about this one, but we have all sorts of strategies. There are market-making strategies which add liquidity to the market. They have prices on the bid side and offer side all the time, or most of the time. And then you're trying to make money capturing the spread in that case. There are also strategies where you have models that predict which way the markets are going to go,
and then you try and trade off of your predictions, and if you're right about the directions of the market, then you can make money that way. I mean, there's nothing magical about any of these ideas. It's just getting the details right.
And so are you doing a lot of research beforehand to figure out trends? I mean, it's a technical analysis type thing?
I mean, it's not what you would think of as traditional technical analysis, but we have large databases of price histories here, and we have a lot of people doing statistical analysis to try and find predictive patterns in those price histories.
Right. Is that the same as what the Jim Simons is doing?
Again, I wish I knew more about what they were doing. They're very secretive, so it's hard for me to compare. But it's my understanding that that their holding periods are a little bit longer than ours, and that their asset base is much larger than ours. But it's the same sort of idea that we have super smart quants and mathematicians and computer scientists working to build automated trading models, and they do the same thing over at Renaissance too. But they're the most successful in the world.
Yeah. And so what is it that do you think that would be different to, like, what is it that got him that scale that you don't? Is it capital? I mean, obviously they're doing different types of research, but is capital one of the big distinguishers? Like, if you were able to get more capital like he has, would that enable you to reach higher levels? Or, like, what we do is
capacity constrained. I mean, I really wish I knew what was so special about them. I mean, they clearly have some very, very smart guys. And I think they have a good work environment, and they're able to work collaboratively together, building some very sophisticated models. And I think to some extent, and again, I don't know, this is pure speculation, it's just their ability to get high-level collaboration between a lot of people on this problem at one time. It's not easy to manage a firm that way, and they seem to do a very good job of it.
Is it difficult for you to be able to retain people that get into some of these sophisticated areas? Because given that the barriers to entry for this sort of stuff, I think, are dropping, are they not, that more guys could just go out and do this on their own?
Well, I mean, what you see is that the markets are constantly getting more efficient. And so, I mean, this is the way capitalism is supposed to work. So you find an anomaly, you trade it for a little while, you make some money, and then other people find it and squeeze it away. And so market inefficiencies are constantly being squeezed away, and we're constantly having to reinvent what we do out there. So it's tricky. It's something you have to constantly be working at just to stay in the game.
Does that not, I mean, so you're not building up, like in other businesses, you build up a brand, you become known, you have systems that back that. Do you not build that with what you're doing? And then you have this constant race where you have to be able to stay on the latest trends in the market?
Well, again, in the little world of quantitative trading, Tower has its own little brand. And we are working here building systems that are, we're constantly making our systems faster and more robust and adding all sorts of functionality. So we are building things here that hopefully will continue to be useful going forward. But proprietary trading is not the most stable and enduring business. I mean, it's got some great properties and some downside. I mean, I very much would rather be in the toothpaste selling business, where you know that people are still going to be buying toothpaste a decade from now. In the business that we're in, the only thing I know for sure is that if we don't reinvent ourselves every year, then someone else is going to come and eat our lunch.
So, I mean, are you still going to be doing this when you're 70?
I have no idea.
Because on the internet, I mean, one of the businesses that's a little bit the same is SEO. Right, and if you get good at doing SEO and optimizing the search results for Google, then you can get a lot of traffic. But the problem guys have with that is that Google comes along and checks things up every year or two, and so a lot of guys spend a lot of time building out sites and networks and all kinds of stuff, and they have it all shaken up, and then they got to start all over from scratch every year. I think by now it's at the point where
it's not really a good business to do, but it was in the past. I would find it frustrating to be doing something where you had to keep being on the run all the time.
Well, I think that's a lot of business right there, and particularly the technology business. I don't think anyone who's in the technology business, the chances are their stuff is not enduring. I mean, you look at Nokia. I mean, they were, not that long ago, 5-8 years ago, top of the world, couldn't do any better, and now they're struggling to stay in business. And, I mean, Apple is on top of the world now, but all it takes is one round of innovation, which you missed. I mean, look at Sony, how well they did with the Walkman and all of that, and now they're an also-ran, practically. So, I mean, that's the nature of the tech business.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Microsoft was on top for a long time, and Bill Gates left, and now they're on the way down. I mean, that's a fair point. Before we go on to, do you have anything else you want to tell us about Tower Research?
I mean, if you have specific questions, it's kind of, I mean, again, I spent, over a decade doing this, so I'm sure I could talk for a while, but I'm not sure how interesting a lot of the details are.
Well, no, I mean, if you have other things you can tell us just about how it works, that would be interesting. I don't actually know what to ask, but everything you said has been really, really interesting to hear. It's a world I've never been exposed to before.
I mean, we're an engineering firm, really, and we have a lot of people. We have some very good network engineers. We have a lot of very good computer programmers. We have a lot of good statisticians and researchers, and we have a bunch of different trading teams that deploy their models in the market, and some of them are quite successful at that.
What are your systems that you're running Linux? Like, what is everyone using to work on?
Yeah, we're mostly C++ on Linux is kind of it is obviously more than that, but that's kind of the basic.
And so it's basically a developer environment, and there's a lot of developers walking around just, writing code and testing stuff and testing different models, is it? And then you find something that's starting to work, so you then deploy it across your trading system, and then that goes out and trades for you?
Yes, that's more or less the idea.
Have you ever had a bug come up and then it's like caused you to either lose or make money?
Yeah. Again, one of the things about trading models is that it's, as opposed to some other types of software, it's not necessarily super clear if it's working or not. So I'm sure that there are lots of little bugs or imperfections in a bunch of the trading parameters. And a lot of what it comes down to is trying to, all the models you build are built on historical data. And so it's all about trying to, if the future looks the same as the past, then you can make inferences about what the future will be like. If the future is different than the past, and that's one of the things about markets is that they are non-stationary and they're constantly changing their behavior. So trying to figure out what is appropriate not for the past but for the future is part of the challenge.
When people complain about high-frequency trading and causing all these rapid losses in the markets and stuff, I mean, is that really being caused by high-frequency trading, or what is causing that?
No, it's not caused by high-frequency trading. It's annoying to be in a business that's being scapegoated for things that it didn't do. So if you look at the flash crash is the thing that most people are familiar with. And there was actually a joint study done by the CFTC and the SEC, and they looked into it. And again, you're talking about markets that were trading under times of extreme stress. Greece was days away from defaulting back when that was a new idea and was absolutely freaking out the world. You had a big spike in volatility, which was causing a lot of the big quant funds to take down their book size, and that was putting pressure on the market. You had a bunch of key technical indicators rolling over, and that was bringing in a set of traders. So into this very, very stressed market, you had a mutual fund in Kansas City that put in an absolutely massive sell order in the S&P futures market, and
And they were using an execution algorithm from one of the big banks that didn't have any proper limits on it. So this thing was running. I mean, it was doing what it was told to do, but what it was told to do was to put in an absolutely massive order that under normal market conditions would have been fine, but under stress market conditions, it just cratered that market, and it just kept trading in a way that a human trader would have said, wait, the guy that placed this order didn't mean for me to be selling this thing in a whole 10%. But because there wasn't any of that common sense or proper checks built in, it was just running, and then the effects from that cascaded from there.
So basically computer error, but then given that the guys are annoyed about losing their jobs and their commissions and stuff from high-frequency trading, then they'd rather blame that on you guys, and that's where it comes from.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the joint SEC-CFTC report, it shows that the high-frequency guys were net adding liquidity and net buyers when the market was going down, but no one, we don't get any credit for that. People still blame us for it, even though it's just not true.
I guess that's business for you. Yeah. So what do you do when there's like huge volatility, like when there was the global financial crisis, that kind of stuff? Like, how does that affect your trading business?
Generally, we like when there's a lot of trading volume. I mean, we basically, the opportunity set that we pursue is more or less proportional to the trading volume out there. And so when there's activity, that tends to be good for our business. I mean, the worst thing for us is when nothing is going on and markets aren't moving and no one's trading, then there's just nothing to do.
So you need volatility, and so when there's a lot of volatility happening, that's when you guys make a lot of money.
I mean, again, there's no different trading strategies behave differently under different circumstances, but the overall opportunity set tends to get larger.
Right. Okay. So before we move on to the next topic, just to backtrack back onto LimeWire, I mean, you went through lawsuits and settlements and everything else. Anything you want to comment on how all that turned out? I mean, yeah, you personally paid a $105 million settlement, didn't you?
Yes.
That's a pretty big settlement, my friend.
Yes.
anything you can say about any of that?
I don't recommend litigation for most people.
You've decided to give that up as a hobby, have you?
trying to get rid of it all. Yes.
Well, that's what you get when you take on dying industries.
Yes. Yeah. I know, but it's. You know, it's still, I mean, I will leave the next person to do the next thing. I've done my share.
Fair enough. Well, congratulations on doing that and settling. Well, did it take a lot of your time going through all the lawsuits?
I mean, at the end when it was very active. I mean, the lawsuit, most of the time nothing is going on, but then there are periods when it's active and it took some time then.
Right. So, you want to tell us about what you're doing with Open Plans?
Sure. So, Open Plans is a not-for-profit that I fund that has two major missions. So, the first is that it focuses on the livable streets movement and transportation reform. So I live in New York City. I've been very active in the livable streets movement in New York City, advocating improving the pedestrian realm and making it easier and safer to bicycle, promoting transit, reducing the harmful impact of the automobile on our society. And so a bunch of the work that we do is focused on that front. We have Streets Blog, which is a blog that covers this topic and is in the transportation world quite influential. And we also have Street Films, which is streetfilms.org. We have 450 videos online where we promote transportation best practices from around the world and highlight what's going on here in New York and in other cities and all around the world. And so, for people in the transportation reform movement, Street Films is quite influential there. And we also, and then a lot of what we do focuses on open source government. And by that I mean advocating for governments using open data standards, open source software, and open source software procurement techniques in order to change the way government information systems are built from the currently basically closed proprietary model that we have now, advocating for it being a system where government funding of software development leads to this open source digital commons. And we're beginning to bootstrap that in a few little areas. Our biggest software project is called OpenGeo, which is a open source geographic information system server and suite of tools around that. And we've been getting a lot of people and government agencies using it, and that's really going quite well. And we have a number of other software projects. A lot of them involve building next generation transportation and land use planning technologies, and also software for civic engagement, for allowing the public to have better input in how government decisions are made. And again, a lot of these ideas are more generic, but we're bootstrapping them, or we're focusing on the transportation area just because that's where we have some expertise, and you kind of have to start somewhere.
I saw a few days ago the president made a mandate around that all aspects of government are going to have to start making APIs available so that everyone can interact with them, and then. Online, I'm seeing in the some of the tech sites, people are saying, well, APIs isn't really enough, and what they need to be doing is making the data available through CSV so that we can really do things with it. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think that certainly one of the big things we're pushing for is this idea of openness in government, and not just conceptually, but in practice. And I do think that open data standards are very important, and then making that data available easily is certainly very important. I mean, there's a lot of data that is locked up just because it's in inaccessible file formats and hard-to-reach formats, and just a lot of operational issues like that. And what you see is that there are the computer systems the government uses are frequently old, cumbersome, complicated, but they work in whichever way they work, and so it's just a very difficult process changing the computer systems anywhere, and government probably even more so. So it's a lot of hard work making these changes happen. It's easy to have the idea. It's a hard thing to actually come up with solutions that people inside government agencies can implement in a reasonable time frame that both serve their end needs to get the job done while also being open and things like that. And I think you can get there, and ultimately we'll be able to see enormous increases of efficiency and cost savings and improvement in transparency and improvement in the way that citizens can interact with various government agencies and reductions in corruption. I mean, a lot of where opportunities for corruption exist is where things are most opaque. And so just getting good levels of transparency does a lot to just make the system work better in terms of both explicit corruption and just implicit corruption in terms of things that are just sloppy and inefficient that maybe no one inside the bureaucracy has an incentive to get rid of, but someone on the outside has an incentive to save tax dollars.
Fair enough. Anything else you want to talk about on open plans before we go on to the next topic?
Well, I will say that I think the core idea that it is, I mean, so the U.S. government spends over $100 billion a year on software. And almost all of that money goes in the form of for closed source proprietary software. But if you can think about if government starts to change the way they procure software and starts to direct that money towards open source procurement, towards building out suites of software that are open source, I think you would see in a fairly short period of time the creation of this digital commons, which can really be a huge resource. So I can give you just one very specific example, which is bike share. So bike share is coming to New York. And as part of that, Open Plans has built for the New York City Department of Transportation a website that allows community members to request a bike share station at a particular location, which is useful when for the people running the system to figure out where they're going to site the stations. And we built this system for New York, and then there's another large city in the U.S. whose name I probably can't actually reveal now, but it's a name brand city. And they are taking the same software. Everything we built was open source. They're taking that software, adapting it to their own system, and able to roll that out. And so what you're seeing is that since New York built this software using open source procurement techniques, you now have a digital resource which other cities can take and build upon and save money doing that. And if you can start to see coalitions of cities, of states, of different sorts of agencies come together to coordinate their funding and to build off of the work the other either cities or states or agencies are doing, then you will start to see this digital commons that's created. And I think that, one, it can save a huge amount of money in software procurement. It opens up government systems, but it also can be a mechanism to be a vector for best practices to be transmitted between these governments. And it also then makes all of that freely available so that poorer cities around the world can adopt these first-class systems for very little money. And I think there's an enormous opportunity there, and this is something that's really quite new and it is on the verge of just really getting started.
I mean, what you're saying there sounds ridiculously obvious and probably the smartest thing I've ever heard of in quite a while, but I've never heard of anyone even mention anything like this before. Why is this not discussed more?
I think there's a few reasons. One, it has to do with government, which is slow and frustrating, and most rational technologists and entrepreneurs will stay in the private sector where you can just innovate faster, move quicker, things like that. Two, this is an idea that isn't about a company making money. And in fact, it's about creating a system where the software companies actually make less money. So I think this is about creating a world where IBM and Oracle and Microsoft are less profitable than they are today, which is actually a good thing for the governments and the end users, but you don't have large corporations advocating for this, and in fact they are advocating against this because it's a world in which the customer, in this case the government, are keeping more purchasing power for themselves and setting up the procurement rules that are not about what benefits companies. And so,
have you ever talked with Richard Stallman about this?
No.
Do you know who Richard Stallman is?
Yes, but I've never spoken to him about anything.
Because I talk with him from time to time on different topics, and this would be right up his alley, and he would be someone that could be quite a promoter of what you're talking about, I would have thought.
Oh, I mean, again, we could use all the help. Really, a lot of it is about getting the government bureaucracies to change what they do and to change how the procurement works, which is just, it's difficult for people that have been conditioned to do something one way for the past 50 years to say, no, you have to do it differently. Because a lot of what you need to do is architect your systems so that they're open. What you tend to have now is a solution where you have some big software vendor, whether it's Accenture or IBM or somebody, comes in and says, I will build you a top-to-bottom solution. and we'll just do everything. And if you're somebody that works inside a government agency, that can be appealing. But really what you want to do if you're inside that agency is say, like, no, we don't want a top-to-bottom solution. What we want is a base layer where we just get our data together and put and get it into standard data formats, and we just create, whether it's, you know, APIs or different sorts of interfaces, just so anybody can get access to this data. And then on top of this data, we want to start building tools, and we want each piece of this to be using open source software and with a bunch of open standards outputs at a series of layers along the way. And it's just a very different way to do business for the government. And it's not particularly tricky or anything, it's just different. And again, if you're a person who is a systems architect, these ideas may seem perfectly natural, but very, very few people who are making procurement systems or procurement decisions inside government are just familiar with these concepts. So that's a lot of what Open Plans is doing, is trying to educate people about this potential. And we've done some projects with the MTA here in New York, the Metropolitan Transportation Agency, where we have built this system with this open data stack for the bus time system. So now New York City buses, it's possible to either on your computer or iPhone see where the buses are. So you can figure out when you want to leave your house or if you want to make a transfer or something like that. And what makes this system different is that it's all open source, it's all open data standards, so anybody who wants to take this feed of information can. And it was a very different procurement model, but if you can get the MTA, which is the largest transit agency in the country, to do this, you really can get anybody to do it. But it took a number of really smart, innovative people inside the agency who were pushing to make this happen, because it was a change in behavior for a large agency. So it takes a lot of people really fighting these battles, both on the inside and the outside, to start making these changes happen.
And the MTA is running your system?
Yes.
And I mean, has it been working well in hindsight?
Yeah, so it's currently rolled out in Staten Island, which is one of the boroughs in New York City. New York City has five boroughs, and it's going to be rolled out in the Bronx very soon, and it'll be across the whole city in within a year or so. And Staten Island, I think within the first few months of it being rolled out, 20% of all people who take the bus there have used it, so I think it's doing pretty well.
Hmm. Congrats.
Thank you.
So running out of time, We should talk about your other website. We need to close. I can stay on a few more minutes. Are you able to, or do you have a hard stop at the end?
No. I can keep going.
Okay. So why don't we talk about you, because you sent me a link to your site, which is jux.com.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what that does?
So it is a, I guess, social media website that allows people to...
This is from the guy who's not on Twitter, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because this is not my vision. There's a guy by the name of Ted Metcalf who is inside Jux, and this is really his vision. And I can see where he's going, and it's right now it's a functional site. It works well for what it does. The biggest group of users now are people who are photographers or who have photo portfolios. It's a really nice, beautiful, clean site on which to post photographs and annotate them, and also just create, even for simple text websites or videos and slideshows, you can put up these things quite easily. And I think eventually we want it to be kind of like a personal content repository for people who want to build up something that's nice on the web, that's not branded as Flickr or Facebook, but that is really your own. You'll see if you use Jux, it really gets out of the way and lets people express themselves in really their own workspace. So we're moving on that, and that's a new thing that's going, and that I hope in a while we'll start to catch on.
Is it a Pinterest clone?
No, it's not. It's really not a clone of anything else out there. And so, I mean, that's actually part of the problem in terms of describing it, is that it doesn't have a complete analog. On one hand, that's good because it's new and novel. On the other hand, it makes it a little tricky to describe.
And is this what you regularly do? You'll just try, like, random different stuff and throw things against the wall and see what sticks?
Not so much. I mean, particularly now that I have Tower, which is a 300-person business, and Open Plans, which is really takes a lot of my time, I just don't have the time to try that many new things. So I'm not saying I'm not trying anything new, but I really have to ration myself. And ideally, I'm not trying to try random things and see what works. I want to try things that I think have a high probability of working.
Yeah. Cool. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us before we wrap up?
I think that that's good. I mean, I can obviously talk for hours, but there's probably a limit to how much people want to hear me talk. So.
Fair enough. All right. Well, Mark, thanks very much for doing the interview.
All right. Thank you.
Awesome.